Well, thank you, Chris and John, for the very enlightening talks and the very objective insights. I think we owe our speakers another round of applause. Thank you. I would now like to invite Miguel and Jos to the podium. Miguel is a professor and Canada Research Chair at Polytechnique and a member of the Girard Multi-University Research Center. He is the director of the Institut de l'Energie Trottier, and he will moderate the question and answer session. Over to you, Miguel.
Thank you, Shubhashish. We now have time for questions, so you're welcome to ask questions. I'll specifically mention you're welcome to ask them in English or French. Alors n'hésitez pas à poser des questions en français. We have microphones in the aisle, so I ask you to please go to the microphones if you wish to have a question and to keep it brief so we have time for as many questions as possible. And at this point, I will invite Mr. Lon Trottier to ask the first question.
Okay, thank you. Very interesting talks. I got the impression from listening to Chris that he felt that a lot of progress is being made and there's some good examples of things that are happening and going in the right direction. I'm just wondering whether both of you think that the move to a more sustainable cities is something that's just going to happen because some of the desirable things that Chris talked about, having more people seeing more pleasant things, more pleasant ways of living and more friendly urban environments and that sort of thing, making a better place to live? Or do we really need something more than that to kind of get things moving in that direction more quickly? And in particular, government policy, is there an important place for the government to bring in certain things like financial incentives, like carbon taxes, efficiency standards, and that sort of things to kind of get us moving in that direction?
Okay, maybe I'll say something. Well, I think maybe what you said is part of it, but I also think that, as Chris pointed out, the millennials, they want to live in those the new urban areas where transit-oriented design is taking place. And also the baby boomers like myself, rather than living out in the suburbs, you know, kind of lonely there, trying to drive to some place where it might be more interesting. I believe we also want to live in a smaller place that's downtown where things are happening and it's much more interesting to live. So I think that's a trend that's happening right now. We did an analysis of a survey by the National Association of Realtors, and it was interesting when we did that analysis. What we found is that what builders were providing wasn't exactly what the buyers wanted. So we weren't seeing as much adoption of this more compact living space, walkable place. So that's an interesting thing, and I think if we were to, you know, get the message out to the builders, they would definitely embrace that. You know, think of the old style. We talked about Europe many times here today. The old style European cities. You had the well, and it was 1 mile from the well, and you walk back and forth. And so all the little shops are there. It's walkable, etc. So I think there will be a trend in that direction. We just need to energize the community, both the builders and the developers, and also the people like myself who would like to live in those spaces.
I do think a lot of it is beginning to shift just on that sort of value proposition, the social aspect of it, the story of it. Part of it too is that the conventional model is failing, and I think we're starting to see these pinch points. And I'll use the example of my city, Calgary. When I moved there in 2003, absolute top of the urban infrastructure agenda, probably the top issue at City Hall was traffic, roads, build more roads, more highways. We need to move cars around. And in just 10 years, absolute top of the civic agenda is we need more LRT lines now, we need more buses now, because we've recognized there, you know, there's limits to how many cars you can shove through a space over the course of a given period of time. And that said, there are some really, really effective things, in some cases, like at the civic level, even just changing regulations that are getting in the way of the right kind of development. I mean, we've put in all kinds of blocks to building mixed-use development in all kinds of communities in Canada. That said, I think the other big incentive is to make saving carbon more attractive, and the way to do that is to put a price on it. I can tell you, because I live in Calgary, many oil companies are already planning for a future with a carbon price in it. It's really just a question of building enough political will so that politicians don't feel like it's a losing issue. And without a doubt, I think we'll see that a lot of the really great innovation, people talk often about Vancouver, and you see a lot of innovation in BC. Some of that is being driven by the fact that they passed the North America's first effective carbon tax. And so I do think, I mean, it seems to me, particularly in this country, we've had a really immature conversation about the cost of carbon, and we need to reset that conversation and have a grown-up one and get something happening there for sure.
Thank you. Ask the next person. Again, if you want to ask a question, please make your way to the microphones and state your question briefly and clearly.
Can I just pose a question, or could I also say something with regard to this topic?
Please keep it brief.
Just to say that since I knew most of the projects that you've been showing, I also know that people have been involved in all of those projects. Now, the question has been, if we need more political guidance, and to some extent, yes, because it is pushing the market and giving it strength. On the other hand, it does also prevent some innovation. A lot of these projects, since it was only an initiative that came, but then a people's initiative that brought the project to what it was in the end. It's both. It's an initiative, but it has to include the people so that the innovation comes and grows from within. My question was, sorry, a totally different topic. Both of you have been mentioning the cars, and that the cars would actually be batteries that are like a little bit decentralized. Now, I know that batteries both ways would always lose energy. What about this energy loss that we had that we would have when we have always this energy transition forth and back, because we don't talk about a lot of power, but each time we are losing energy. So each time we're maybe just subtracting a little bit of energy, but the loss will always be there.
Yeah, well, I'll just answer briefly, and John may be able to speak to it as an engineer more. The one thing I do know is that if we were comparing this system to a 100% efficient system, that would be a bigger problem. But the system we have has enormous inefficiencies, and I mean, just the heat loss from centralized power plants is extraordinary. The fact that we blow all this heat out of smokestack rather than in some way actually utilizing it. So my understanding is that hasn't been an impediment either from a technical point of view, in that when the engineers, for example, in Denmark who are looking at this look at it, they have not seen energy loss through that transfer to be significant enough to matter. And then it does seem to be, you know, as the companies that are looking at kind of building out that technology look at it, doesn't seem to be affecting their market decisions either. So maybe you can speak to the technical aspects of it, John, I'm not sure.
I think you said it.
Yeah.
In terms of the storage, you will lose some energy with the batteries, but it's not going to be a huge amount compared to centralized power plants, if you can capture all that energy. So, and then of course, keep in mind that we use about 15 terawatts. I keep using these numbers, but 15 terawatts of energy is in the primary energy use in the world. The sun delivers 186,000 terawatts of energy. So, there's quite an opportunity there in terms of renewables. So, something to keep in mind.
For the sake of time, we'll move to the next question, please.
Thank you. I just wanted to respond to a point you made, Dr. Crittenden, about population. And population undoubtedly is a very important issue, because the latest United Nations projections show that the world population is not likely to stabilize even by about 2070 or so. And at that point, it's likely to hit about 10 billion. But the graphic you showed, showing the relationship between total fertility rate and infant mortality rate, actually is I think a source for encourage. You know, it's a very encouraging sign. And basically, what it shows is that as infant mortality rate comes down, you know, parents become more. They're more confident that their children will live into, you know, go on to adulthood, and therefore it in fact pushes down the need to have more children. And I don't think very honestly that about 80% of the world will ever reach the consumption levels that we have, first of all, because we've run through all of the resources. So that isn't going to happen. But what we need to do is to increase, in fact, consumption for them very slightly in terms of access to clean water and clean energy and so forth, because the less access to they have to those kinds of resources, the greater is the need for children at the level of households, which, of course, pushes up population, fertility rates and birth rates.
Was there a question in that? I think
well,
you're
I
on
mean,
the same
I,
page.
Well, it was more a comment because
if,
you know, you talked
okay,
about population.
Then we've got some other questions okay. behind you, and we're short of time.
Anyway, I agree with you. I think that's well put.
Please
you know,
be brief.
I went over it very quickly, so I didn't have an opportunity to say everything I wanted to say. But, yeah, the whole idea of I'm just saying I wouldn't say that we would want the that other 9 billion people to use the same resources. I think we're going to have to manage our expectations as well. And also we want to have them have an opportunity to live a useful and productive life. Because I think that's the seed of tyranny, terrorism, and a lot of other bad things. Because if everyone does have, you know, they're more concerned about their families, their future, that's where we want people to be. If that's a smaller investment than what we are and the Golden Billion have, fine. I'm reminded of a country called Bhutan. Have you heard about Bhutan? In Bhutan, they have a different way, a different metric. Instead of GDP, they talk about gross domestic happiness. And I have slides I could show you sometime about happiness and resources that you have control over. It doesn't go in the direction you think. They don't call it affluenza for nothing, you know, instead of influenza, you know, the dogged pursuit of more. You just feel like you have to you look around and say you have this many resources at your command, and it's always not enough. You go up, 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 and you're never happy. You haven't ever stepped back and asked yourself, what are my expectations and how can I manage my expectations so I can still lead a useful and productive life and still be happy? Anyway, just another whole thought on that whole subject. So you're right. I think a smaller increase in their livelihoods may not be the same as what we need, and we may need less as well to be as happy. So anyway, managing expectations and resources.
Our time is getting short, but there are still more questions, so please go ahead quickly.
Thank you for your presentation. My first question is about the combined heat and power. Since heat loss during transmission is much more than electricity loss in transmission, I can imagine that perhaps these combined heat and power sites should be in close proximity of the consumer. So I was wondering if there is any safety hazard or noise pollution problem or pollution problem that comes with it. And my second question is regarding the electric cars. It is very interesting for me that Tesla, for example, was formed in the U.S. because, well, in Quebec, we have hydro, we have clean electricity. But in the U.S., which still relies on coal-fired power plants and thus I don't think has a clean electricity, is electric car a green option? Thank you.
So I'll answer the Tesla question, and then you can talk about commodity and power. So the electric car in and of itself is, yes, to some degree, only as green as the grid it's on. That said, if an electric car is replacing internal combustion engine, there is some, you know, life cycle gain. And that's why the first part of my presentation was entirely about getting past cars. I think cars need to be a smaller and smaller piece of our daily lives, but they're still going to be a piece of it for the foreseeable future. So certainly, you know, reducing the level of greenhouse gases coming from out tailpipes is a net gain. The other thing I like about it is obviously that even if something isn't necessarily going to be the solution, it might be a way, and cars, you know, certainly fill this sort of role in our society, to get people, to open people up to the idea that business as usual is not the only way to think about these things. So even if 20 years from now, 50 years from now, we have reduced the, and you're already seeing this among young people, reducing the amount of car ownership and the idea that that's an essential piece of the good life or whatever. For now, that might not be a bad way to get people, certain segments of the marketplace that wouldn't be otherwise engaged in sustainability issues, to open up to them. That's part of the reason, incidentally, why Tesla made their first cars to be crazily high performance, was to get past the image problem that electric cars had, that they were glorified golf carts and all that kind of stuff. You know, Elon Musk, when he founded the company, that was a clear goal of his, was we want the Tesla to be the coolest thing on the road. And that's how we will get people to take electric vehicles seriously.
John?
Okay. I think what I heard was that is CHP safe? And also, is there pollution associated with the combined heat and power? And what I was talking about was decentralized combined heat and power using microturbines. On the pollution piece, it's going to be better than coal in a centralized power plant. We're in the process right now of doing the health issues related to air quality result from wide distribution of the combined heat and power versus coal. We haven't gotten there yet, but coal creates quite a few particles. There's mercury, there's other things that are in the coal. So I'm hopeful that the CHP, from a pollution point of view, is going to be better. It certainly has a lower CO2 carbon footprint per megajoule of energy, making sure that you don't lose natural gas along the way. In terms of safety, I think there won't be too much of an issue there. We have a furnace in our house right now that might catch fire, that might explode. And I don't think many of us, if you have a furnace in your house, I don't know how many people are scared of their furnace, but I think there's ways of designing your furnace now that's also electrical energy generator to be safe. And also I think we need to talk about the Internet of Things. Because now what we have is a variety, lots of turbines out there that need to be monitored, and people need to go around and make sure they're serviced. So they give you a call. They say, hey, I'm at the design end of my design cycle right now, or I'm not working properly. I'm going to come. And so you have service people running around making sure that the turbines are working. They also would be more resilient, because now instead of one central plant, if it goes down, and then the cascading effects that might go from that, you just have a couple of turbines and maybe some others that could feed in. So I think that's another thing. And I agree that electric vehicles might be more polluting, but not so far. The analysis that was done by NREL showed that even with the existing power plant generation, even though you're using coal, would still be greener than using gasoline. So because of the efficiency. The issue is this. Internal combustion engine is not very efficient, maybe 15-20%. Every joule in, 15-20% out the back on the for the wheels. Electric motors are very, very efficient. Now, on the front end, of course, we've got to think about how that's that electrical energy produced. Again, Chris was talking about PVs or wind, so that's another way, that's not going to have as large of a carbon footprint as well.
Thank you. It's wonderful to see so much interest to ask questions and discuss this topic. Unfortunately, for reasons of time, we only have time for one more question. So I'll ask the gentleman to go ahead.
Thank you for the presentation. My question is around how can you get the hype going and how can you cause a paradigm shift in people's mentality towards sustainable living? What would be the spark to cause that change, especially that people are going to be less, they're going to be more resilient to accepting the change, especially that they want change to be now, but it's all long-term benefits, but they can't see that. They just want things to happen at the moment. So what would be that, how can you educate people to accept the change, that it's good for you, despite the fact that there's going to be an initial cost for switching to being having a sustainable life?
Right. I think it's a really good question and a really important one, because we've been well aware of the scale of the problem for 20-odd years now. There have been lots of really, really great solutions lying around and getting better all the time, and yet adoption is not anywhere near universal yet. I don't think there's a single catalyst. I don't think there's I think it's going to be a whole bunch of different conversations that will look very, very different in each jurisdiction where they occur. But I think the important thing will be that it will not be it won't be this sort of coercive process so much as something a lot more idiosyncratic, I guess is the right word. And let me give a concrete example so it doesn't sound completely vague. One of the things I've looked at is Walmart's sustainability program. Was met with an enormous amount of skepticism when they made that commitment to sustainability as their new bottom line in 2005. There are still absolutely lots of things you can point at in their business model and say, that's not sustainable, their land use is terrible, whatever else. But one of the interesting things that came of that, I spoke to some of the consultants who worked with Walmart, and what they realized was that even within that one business, and now granted it's Walmart, it's a huge business, but the conversation in every single business unit in the company was different. And for example, a guy by the name of Adam Werbach, who used to be the head of the Sierra Club in the United States, was considered a traitor when he went off to work for Walmart. He was doing consulting at the store level on sustainability. Walmart basically said, go into stores, the stores will invite you. We're giving the managers the opportunity to invite you to come and talk to them about sustainability initiatives. And when he first started doing it, he thought, oh yes, I'm going to come to liberate these oppressed Walmart workers from their chains. And what he found was that by and large, at least in the stores he was being brought to, these people were pretty proud of their jobs, and whether they were great jobs or not, they liked them a lot. And that what he found was, if you simply said, what does sustainability mean to you, sometimes you'd get people saying, what we need to do is organize ourselves so that we can get monthly bus passes and not all have to drive. Other times it would be personal stuff about health issues, like I need to quit smoking or I should lose some weight or whatever else. But what he found was, it didn't matter where the conversation started, you had to let it start where it wanted to. You couldn't show up from on high and sort of present these people. And I think that's really why I say it's going to be a pretty idiosyncratic conversation. There are going to be people who are drawn to this stuff for reasons that are the reasons I'm drawn to it. There's going to be people who are drawn to this stuff because they got really sick of the commute and they decided they wanted to not have to spend an hour in their car every day or whatever else. So I don't think it is a single catalyst. I think there's a million different conversations going on in a billion different communities about this.
I'd like to add, and I couch this with the statement, don't underestimate what young people really want. I remember one time I made a lecture to my daughter's fourth grade class about climate change. And they were all really engaged, and they were all excited about what the future was. And they were all very upset about it. So the next day when I got home from work, my daughter said to me, what are you doing about that, Dad? Well, on a more adult level, I mean, there are plenty of younger people who don't want to be associated with communities that are wasting resources. They really want what we've been talking about here. So I think there'll be a push. It won't be a push. There'll be a pull. We just need to give it some time.
Thank you. On that note, I'll ask Shubhashish to join me again at the podium. And again, apologies to those who had questions and wanted to ask them, but unfortunately we're out of time. It does give me the opportunity to mention that tomorrow we have another day of another evening of this year's symposium here, same time, same place. And next year, the second annual symposium will be hosted by EIT at Polytechnique, as Professor Savar mentioned, on May 4th and 5th. So please mark your calendars.
I will just say a very few quick words about what we do at TISET and how you can connect with us. Although we are a very new institute, we already have 50 member professors, and they are engaged in research, technology and policy-related research on sustainability, and they work in collaboration with IET and various other organizations. So there's a range of sustainability issues that we work on, urban transportation, urban development, renewable energy, aviation, and IT. Teaching is also a very big mandate for us. I think the most important thing that I want to say is that there are many ways to connect with TISED, and I encourage you to get to our website. There are really many ways to get involved, and I hope you will be. We'll be posting announcements of future seminars and publications on the website, so please look out. Miguel and I would like to end by expressing some thanks in closing. And I would like to express my sincere thanks to the organizing committee, which included members of IET and TISED and Miguel. Very big thank you to many who have worked behind the scenes on communications, event planning, external relations, both at McGill and at Polytechnique. I would also like to particularly thank Lauren Penny, TISED manager, as well as our many student volunteers for all their excellent efforts in organizing the symposium. So please come back tomorrow. There are very interesting presentations, three very interesting presentations on sustainable industries. Same time, same place. Merci beaucoup. Bonsoir.